We'll meet one of the leaders of these groups, Doris Agins. She's the national coordinator of RID, that's the acronym for Remove Intoxicated Drivers. Last night, the Philadelphia Festival Theater premiered a new play called Triple Play, three vignettes about baseball. In about 45 minutes, the director, Lynn Thompson, will be with us. With me now is Ron Luciano, who during the decade that he umpired in the American League was known as one of the most talkative, eccentric, and flamboyant umpires in baseball. When he retired from umpiring in 79, he used his penchant for talking by joining NBC TV as a color commentator for the NBC Game of the Week. He got a start in sports as a pro football player, and he's written about his experiences as an umpire in a new book called The Umpire Strikes Back, which has just been published by Bantam Books. Ron Luciano, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry. Do you like the title, Umpire Strikes Back?
Yes, I do. We all thought it was very funny.
Well, what happened was, I'm very stupid, and I believed that umpire was spelled with an E, so it was just natural that I would spell Empire Strikes Back.
Are you going to be marketing, like, cups and toys with your title on it?
Oh, I hope so, because basically, I love money. I love money, and so if I can do anything to get myself more money, that would be great.
Well, tell me the truth. Are umpires really unpopular?
Most of people believe we were born in Transylvania. We had no mother and father. Actually, I was born to very poor parents. I had a mother, but we were too poor for a father. I never had a childhood. I was born at the age of 23, and most of the rest of the years of my life, I was spent in a cage, and they fed me raw meat until I was ready to umpire, and then they allowed you out just for the games and then put back into the cage. So naturally, umpires are very, very mean, dirty, bad-speaking people.
Do all umpires go through this training?
Yes. They have to go through those training. Two of the things that you must be in order to be an umpire is the number one thing is stupidity. And what happened is I played pro football for so many years without a helmet, and I kept hitting the frozen ground, and my head would be jostled and the reins gone. The second thing is you have to be blind. And I went to my optometrist, and he said, definitely you will receive aid from the government. You're very close to being able to carry a white cane. So with being stupid and blind, the only thing left open to me was umpiring, and so I went into umpiring.
This definitely sounds like the job description that I guess a lot of players would write for umpire, huh?
Oh, yeah. They treat us like non-entities. They will say things to an umpire that they would never even say to their priest or their wives or anybody else. So basically, I'm a gossip, and I learned great things while I was on the field because they figured, well, he's part of the field. He's like a base. You know, he can't talk back. He smiles every once in a while, but I think he cracks his face when he does it.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that most ball players consider looking or talking to an umpire as like watching paint dry. It's not very exciting.
Well, you knew the reputations that umpires had when you became one.
Oh, no. Oh, no. I was never going to be an umpire. No child ever grows up and said, oh, I want to be an umpire someday. Nobody is that stupid to begin with. I mean, nobody can be that dumb. What happened was that I played pro football, and I get highs from sports. I mean, I really do. There's something about excitement about the last minute of play and the other team to go ahead, and I get so excited. I just love every second of it. I went home, and I started to teach after pro football. Right? They got wise to me. I played for about 5 years, and I never played a game. I found out that on Sunday afternoon you can get hurt, and I hate pain. So what I did, I got the big boo-boo at the beginning of the year. I would get a dislocated shoulder out for the season. Terrific. They pay me. They never knew whether I was good or bad because I wouldn't play. Then I'd come back next year. They'd give me a raise, and I'd start all over again. Right? Again, I would get the big hurt at the beginning of the year. The entire year I'd sit out. They'd give me a raise and come back again. Finally, they got wise. It was Detroit that first got wise. I went up to them at the end of the year. After the third year, I figured, hey, these guys know what's coming off. Right? So I went in, and I said, listen, I will help you any way you want. Any way that Ron Luciano can help the Detroit Lions, let me do it. Play center, play guard. You just tell me how I can help the Lions. They sent me to Minnesota. Now, that's a terrible way to help that team. So what happens, Buffalo got smart, and they got me out of football. I went back home, and I started to teach school. And believe me, I went and I got my BS in math, and then my master's in education administration. So I wanted to be a school teacher like everyone in my hometown. I come from a small little community, 17,000 people, 16,000 Italians and all relatives. We own the school system. Oh, there are Lucianos on the board. Our teaching salary list every week when the checks come out, it reads like a pizza menu. You know, Della Penta, Luciano, all right down the line. So I had to become a teacher. That's what I was going to do. I found out after 1 year of teaching that I hated children. I cannot stand children. Oh, they are terrible, horrible people. That children should not allow to be born. You should be born at the age of 65 and then grow younger, because it's just a waste of so many years out of your life. Terrible. Hate children. Called up a friend of mine, Spike Briggs, who was co-owner of the Lions and the Tigers. This was the Detroit Lions, a football team, and Detroit Tigers, a baseball team. And I said, please, Spike, get me back into baseball. I'm going crazy. What I did was, if the kids came in, they got a 30 on the test, I'd give them 100. I was a football player in college. That's what they did with me. I didn't realize that you had to earn your own grades. So I was a terrible teacher. I said, please, get me back into baseball. He said, Ronnie, why would I hire you? And I said, why? He said, you were a lousy football player. You'll probably be a lousy anything in football. Why would I hire you back? I said, oh, come on, stop getting around. Give me a job. He said, I'll get back to you. Call me back in a month, and he said, okay, I got it. You're Eastern Regional Director of Scouting. And I said, terrific. What do I do? He said, on Friday nights and Saturday night afternoons, you go to ball games and you rate ball players. I said, oh, no. I want a full-time job. I don't want any weekend type of thing. I want to work full-time, 365 days in sports. He said, I'll get back to you. Right? A year later, he calls me back and he says, I got it. And I said, terrific. What is it? He said, you're going to be a general manager in baseball. Terrific. I said, great. He said, what do you know about baseball? I said, I know more baseball than I do football. He said, uh-oh, we're in trouble because you know nothing. I said, no, don't kid, Spike. I said, what's a general manager do? I was so nervous. I knew nothing. Right? He explained to me what a general manager does, and it's the best definition I've ever heard in the last 20 years. A general manager of a ball club, he said, tries to get the people to come to the ballpark and pay for seats, and you try to keep the club from tearing up the town. Now, if you know ball players, all they do in life is want to tear up towns. So it was a great definition. I said, all right, what do I do and where? He said, in Lakeland, Florida, it's our lowest team. It's an A league. And he says, all you go down there and you handle the young kids, try to get the people in the ball. I said, terrific. Great job. I'm on my way. This was in November. I resigned from school during the semester break in January. And I went to Florida. Now, I wasn't supposed to start until March 1st. So I had a couple of months off in Florida. I read in the paper that there's a baseball school going on. So I said, terrific. I'll go to the baseball school, and I'll take a general managership course, and I'll understand what the heck I'm supposed to be doing out there. I went to the school. I went in, and I said, okay, I want to sign up. I want to sign up for general managership. They said, hey, buddy, what are you talking about? This is an umpire school. I said, what? He said, an umpire school, baseball umpire school. And I said, fine, I've been to school all my life, right? Work on towards my doctorate. Right? What do I know? Sit down. Sign me up. I walked out in the field, and I loved it because they started, the first words out of their mouth were, you're God. And I said, yes, I agree. They said, it's your bat, it's your ball, and it's your ballpark. If the ball player stands up and you want him to sit down, you tell him to sit down. If he doesn't, you fine him. I said, oh, what power. The kids never listen to me. These guys have to listen to me. He says, if they swear at you, you throw them out of the ball game, you charge them money. I said, are you kidding me? This is terrific. I love it. I said, do I have to get in shape like I did in football? No. I said, great. Do they hurt me? They no hurts. Never. They can't touch you. If they touch you, they put them in jail. I said, my type of job. Let me do this. Now they told me the bad parts. Okay, first of all, I called up Spike Briggs and I said, Spike, I got the job. I don't want your general managership job. And he said, thank you, because you would have probably done the same thing, but hung on for 5 or 6 years and I would have paid you money and you wouldn't have done anything. I said, no, I'm going to be an umpire. He said, terrific. What's an umpire? Here is a man that owns a major league club and did not know what an umpire was. He referred to them, he was football oriented. He referred to them as officials. He never knew what an umpire was. I said, no. He said, well, who hires you? And I said, a league. He said, well, I don't own a league. I said, I know you don't own a league, but listen, I want to go to your spring training camp. And he said, okay, who pays you? And I said, you do. He said, I don't own a league. I said, I know you don't own a league. Just pay me for spring training. He said, okay. Now, who hires you? And I said, the league hires me. And he said, okay, good. Now, who pays you? And I said, well, you will in spring training. He said, you make those calls against me on the field and I pay you? He said, what kind of a job is this? I said, that's what I'm telling you. It's a great job. It's a terrific job. You know, you hit the people that feed you. It's great. Anyway, we went back in. I started in A ball, and you're supposed to spend 2 years in A, 2 years in AA, 2 years in AAA. I spent a year in A, a year in B, 2 years in AAA, and then went into the majors and loved it ever since.
My guest, Ron Luciano, has written a book about being an umpire, and it's called The Umpire Strikes Back. And let's talk about being behind the plate. You spent a lot of time there behind home plate, umpiring strikes and balls. Where do you look when it's, I think, a half second it takes from the pitch to get from
one
the pitchers?
Fifth of a second. All right, now a fifth of a second, a batter. This is how tough it is to play baseball. A good baseball player, right, hits 300. That means every 10 times he's at bat, he'll get three hits. And that is fantastic. Mike Schmidt with the Phillies, greatest hitter that ever lived, but he only does 3 out of 10 things right. Can you imagine anyone else in the business? Can you imagine yourself, Terry? You read 10 sentences, 3 correctly, 7 incorrectly. You'd be ostracized in 2 seconds. A tennis player hit 10 shots, 3 good, 7 bad. Horrible tennis player. You couldn't do it. Same way with a golfer. I love a racetrack driver. Go around the track 10 times, 3 times well, 7 times the opposite way. You know, it just doesn't work. That's how hard it is to play baseball. He has 1/5 of a second to decide what the pitch is and another 1/5 of a second to start his swing to hit it. So it's about 2/5 of a second from the time the ball leaves his hand to the time it gets to the plate. And I'm supposed to make a decision in that time. What happens is last year in the American League, the average pitcher threw 148 pitches. Now, there are 2 pitchers pitching each game, so that they throw approximately 300 pitches. The ball players swing at 90. So an umpire behind home plate makes 200 decisions in 2.5 hours, right? And now, although they told us we were God, God couldn't even be right 200 times in 2.5 hours. So I could never understand why they used to get mad at me, because I figured if a hitter only got 3 out of 10 right, if I got 3 out of 10 right, I was as good as he was. But they didn't go that way. They wanted all 200 right and to be better the next night. And you just can't do those things.
Well, where do you look? The ball's coming. You've got 2/5 of a second. What are you looking at?
What you do, it's explained by optometrists. Thank the Lord for eye people. They said that there's no way that you can watch the ball come in for 60 feet. What you do is you pick an area by the place, by the plate. You look at home plate and you pick an area. Now, you watch that area. If the ball passes through that area, then it's a strike. And if it doesn't, with your peripheral vision, you'll see it goes by and out of that area, and then it's a ball. And so you pick an area, you look at it, you set your strike zone in your eye. If the ball hits there, what you try to do is become automatic. You try to become a robot. And as the pitch comes in, it hits the area, up goes your arm, you say strike, and everybody says terrific. And the ball comes in, it doesn't hit that area, you say ball, and then everybody cries because you missed the play. But it's very, very hard. You can't be right that many times. And there are certain pitchers. Nolan Ryan is one. Nolan Ryan throws the fastest ball in either league right now. He throws the ball at over 100 miles an hour. Now, the average in last year's National League was 88 miles an hour. Now, he throws over 15 miles an hour faster. Now, the way you relate that is go down the highway at 55 and have somebody go by you at 70. It's like you're standing still. You can't see it. And when Nolan used to throw the ball, I'd be behind home plate. Brian Downing's the catcher. And Brian would get down there in his crouch. He'd call for the pitch. The first pitch would come in, hit his glove, and I'd say, ball sounds low. He said, sound? And I said, listen, he throws it so fast, I don't see it. I'm going to have to go by sound today. And usually the batter would say, didn't it sound outside too? I say, yeah, normally. He was the only man in my life that I've ever, have you ever heard the expression exploding fastball? Okay, it's a baseball term. And even if you're not interested in baseball, it sounds good, an exploding fastball. Well, Nolan Ryan, I've heard it for years. Even as a kid, I heard exploding fastball. I didn't know what it was. I'm umpiring behind the plate in Anaheim, California. This was before Nolan Ryan, who now is with Houston. You can't keep up with these guys. They keep changing. First Pete Rose is Cincinnati, now he's Philadelphia. They keep changing around. Anyway, he was with the California Angels, Nolan Ryan was. And he's throwing the ball in, and we're about the 4th inning, and the first time I've ever seen him. And as the pitch is coming in, just as it gets to home plate, the cover comes off. I mean, literally, it explodes in front of my eyes and the cover comes off. I turn my head away and duck, and I say, oh, my gosh, can you imagine that? And I'm waiting for the crowd to say, oh, 60,000 people are going to say, he threw the cover off the ball. And I look back up and open my eyes, and the catcher's throwing it back to the pitcher. I mean, I saw it explode. No one else did. And I'm saying, oh, they finally gone. The eyes have finally left me. There is no hope for me again. I've lost a job. I'm out of it. It's terrible. It's horrible. What am I going to do? We go through a couple more innings, and it happened four times that game. The ball came in, the cover came off, and I'm the only idiot there that saw it. I couldn't wait to get off the field. I run off the field. I run into Freddie Federico, who's the trainer. And I go in, and I said, Freddie, you got to get me an eye doctor quick. And he said, listen, I've known that for years, Ronnie. And I said, no, don't kid around. This is not a kidding matter. The ball is coming apart on me. He said, listen, you've been coming apart for years. I said, Freddie, stop it. Get me to an eye doctor. So he sent me to quote, a jock doctor, which is super because they've been in sports all their life and they know what the heck's coming off. And I walked in and he checked the eyes out and he said, fine, you're blind, but that's normal for an umpire. I said, no, something happened. I explained it to him. He said, it's very simple. Other ballplayers have come in and asked me about it. And he said, I've studied it, and it's a very simple explanation. What happens is when the pitcher is 60 feet away, that's quite a distance. So if you look 60 feet away, you see a small golf ball in his hand. Now, normally when the pitcher throws the ball, your eyes adjust, and it gets larger as the ball comes in. But with Nolan, he throws it so rapidly that when the time it leaves his hand, it's a golf ball until it's right in front of you. Then it does not have time to expand, but while it's 2 feet in front of you, it goes from golf ball size, pop, cover comes off, and it goes to natural size. And he says, it's just an optical illusion. And I said, that's great, but for an umpire, that's tough. It's really hard. There's only one other pitcher in my 16 years of umpiring that did that to me, and that's J.R. Richards, who is out of the ball game now. He had a heart attack a few years back, and he threw the ball that exploded two or three times a ball game. Not every pitch, but only about two or three times a game.
Well, how do you call a ball like that?
I don't. It's by sound. I just cry a lot and hope they swing. No, what happens is that, again, the robot takes over, and even the ball expands. Either it goes outside of that little zone that you look for or inside that little zone. See, umpires are not precise. We do a lot of guessing out there. There was no way that a ball traveling 90 miles an hour, and I umpired for 11 years in the major leagues, and I never once saw a pitcher throw the ball straight. The ball moves. If it's a fastball, it'll rise or lower. If it's a slider, what they call a slider, the ball comes in on a straight trajectory and then literally moves sideways. It slides, and usually down at the same time. It'll come in on a flat surface, slide to the left or right, and then down. And a curveball has a little arc to it. And it will move as much as 12 to 16 inches. It will come in and then drop, like, literally off the end of a table, okay? And they talk about a hanging curveball. That's a curveball that doesn't break. They mean it only breaks 8 inches. It doesn't break the 14 or 16. So every pitch moves. And I do a lot of guessing out there. You have to.
Well, when you know that you've really guessed on one and you're not certain, and the batter's starting to argue with you, and everybody's yelling with you, fans and people in the dugout, what would you ever confess that, well, you know, I wasn't exactly sure of that, but I think it was a strike.
Yeah, well, see, what happens is that you find out over the years that they're not sure either, okay? But they're hoping in their heart that it was a ball rather than a strike. And so they look at you pleading and say, how can you call that a strike? The ball was low. And you look at them and say, listen, you got to learn how to hit that pitch. They're going to pay you $1 million a year. You got to hit those things. Right? Or what you try to do, you use psychology on them. You find out very early because a ball player will swing at a pitch that's up at eye level. I mean, it's so high, it's ridiculous. Then he'll turn around to you, and just to reassure himself, he'll say, was the pitch high? Now, the next pitch comes in, and you're not too sure. It might be a quarter to a half an inch off the plate. So it missed by a quarter and a half an inch. And he'll say, that pitch is outside. And I say, you can tell a quarter of an inch, but you can't tell 2 feet over your head. And so they really don't know. And what you have to be is a psychologist and make them believe that you're right many more times than you're wrong. And what I did, I double-talked them a lot. And also, I intimidated him. I'm 6'4 and weigh 300 pounds. So even a man standing there with a bat, I would say, you don't like that pitch? The next one's going to be a strike no matter where it is. Now do you like the pitch? Yeah, usually. Well, it's a pretty good pitch, Ron. You're right. And so intimidation works very well for umpires.
Has an umpire ever changed their call?
Only I have. Now, but me, I'm different than most umpires. But I did. It happened in Baltimore, Maryland. Now, first of all, not too many people want to go to Baltimore. I'm feeling Philadelphia is beautiful, but Baltimore is the pits, let's face it. I've always said Baltimore is full of crabs. You know, they eat a lot of crabs down there. People get mad at me for that, especially people in Baltimore. But we were in Baltimore on a beautiful Sunday afternoon, and I was down the third baseline. And when you're down the third baseline, the most thing you have to worry about is a ball being fair or foul. And there's a big foul line out there, and the ball either goes to the right of it, it's fair, and if it goes to the left of it, it's foul. It's very simple, okay? The man hit the ball, and he was with the California Angels, again, the Angels. He was with the Angels, and he hit the ball down the line, and we're in Baltimore. And now I looked up and I said, oh, it's a gorgeous sun, but where the heck is the ball? And I don't know where the ball is. I knew it was either going to be fair or foul, home run or not a home run. So I've got a 50-50 chance. So I'm going to let the fans decide it for me. Because if they're in Baltimore and it's not a Baltimore person hitting, the fans would usually go, oh, no, darn, right? So I listen and they go, oh. Well, that's not conclusive, but I wasn't too sure. So I looked at the left fielder. Now, the left fielder should be happy if it was foul and sad if it was a home run. And I looked, and his chin was on his chest. I said, what the heck? Got to be a home run. 50-50 chance. Let's go with it. And I jumped in the air and twirled my arm around in the form of a home run. And while I was coming down, Brooks Robinson, who's a third baseman with Baltimore, who has never said anything to an umpire, referred to my mother in a very derogatory manner. It was horrible. At the same time, I looked in the bullpen, who was not allowed on the field, climbed over the fence and were trying to tear my clothes off. At the same time, not all the fans, but half of them were on the field. At this point, I figured I might have missed it. I wasn't sure, but I figured I might have erred some way or another. I went in towards the home plate umpire, who's on the same line as I am and therefore should be able to tell. And I looked, and it was Armando Rodriguez, who's a great, dear friend, but he only speaks Spanish. And I don't speak Spanish, only English, and not that very well. Now, there's no way that I can explain to this man that I didn't see it because I saw the sun. And if he doesn't change it or make it do something right now, the least that's going to happen to me is I'm going to be shot. Most likely, I would be hung, crucified, and stabbed at the same time. But the least thing is I cannot explain this to him. So I went over to first base, which is about 2,000 yards away. And now I'm going to ask this guy whether or not, you know, it was fair or foul. The umpire at first base was a man by the name of Bill Haller. And Bill Haller, we started together, and he'd spent 20 years in the American League. He started when he was 25. He was now 84. He aged so rapidly in the years that I worked with him. It was unreal. He's old, decrepit, carried a cane. I said, Bill, fair or foul? He says, are you nuts? That's the worst call I've ever seen in baseball. I thought you were kidding. The ball was 40-foot foul if it was an inch. He said, I figured when you jumped in the air, you had to be kidding because nobody has ever been that bad in the history of baseball. I said, well, I change it. He said, what do you mean change it? You can't change it. I said, why not? He said, because all umpires do not change a decision. He said, something's got to happen. I said, I'll change it. Don't worry about it. He said, if you change that play right there, the other manager, Dick Williams from the Angels, is going to go crazy and you're going to have to throw him out of the ballgame. I said, what the heck? I've done that all my life. There's nothing wrong with that. I'll throw him out of the ballgame. So I went over to Earl Weaver and I said, hey, Earl, it's the foul ball. And out comes Dick Williams, and he looks at me like a long-lost friend. He says, what's going on? I said, I'm changing it to a foul ball. He says, changing it? You got to be kidding me. I've been in baseball for 35 years. Baseball is 115 years old. No goddamn umpire in the world has ever changed a decision. What are you going to change it? I said, yeah. He said, you're going to have to run me out of this game. I said, okay. Ready? You're going. He said, no. Don't you run me yet. He said, first of all, when you run me, I want you to jump in the air and twirl around and do it the same way you called the home run. I want you to put on a show and show everybody what an idiot you are and how you're going to throw me out of the game. I said, okay, you ready to go? Oh, no. First, I want to talk about your mother. And I said, oh, here we go again. He made references to her. And I said, you ready to go? No, I don't want to go yet. He talked about everything. I mean, my cousins, he used some words that I took out a notebook and wrote down because I had to go back and look them up in the dictionary. They were not new to me. They were swear words sailors don't even know. I mean, unreal. Finally, after about 7 or 8 minutes, I said, are you ready? He finally said, yes. So I jumped in the air, did a little pirouette, came down again, jumped up again, did a somersault, 1.5 spin while I'm in the air, came down, threw him out of the game for the second time, and he started to leave, and he turned around and he said, that was even better than the home run, thank you. And he walked off the field.
Well, look, if no umpire ever changes a call, why does everybody spend so much time fighting?
Okay, this is a non-contact sport. All right. A batter gets up there, swings at three pitches, and he misses. Now, in football, if somebody misses a tackle, what they do the next time is bite the guy in the leg or hit him in the mouth or do something to get rid of their hostilities. And in basketball, which is a non-contact sport, more elbows are thrown than anything else. The most brutal thing besides the tickets is the contact on the floor. And in hockey, they just try to constantly take off their gloves and bang each other. But in baseball, there's nothing to hit. So the only way you can fight back is verbally. And who are you going to fight with? The fans? They pay on their way to the ballpark. You're going to fight with your own team? Of course not. You share everything together with those guys. And you can't fight with the other team because you might be on that other team next week. So who's left? That idiot in blue. And therefore, you take all your hostilities out on him. And it's a great therapy. What it is, it's a free couch lesson. Because they come in there and they scream, yell, and holler, and wail their arms around and flail at different directions. They know it's not going to be changed, but as they go back, the crowd, attaboy, good going, that's the way to yell at that Luciano, you are super, they call him all those names. And all of a sudden, you can see a broad smile on his face, and all the hostility is gone, and he's back to being human. I mean, he can go home, and he won't beat his wife, you know, he won't yell at the kids, the dog doesn't get kicked. It's great therapy for him to yell. The reason they yell is not to change the decision, but just to get it off their chest so they'll feel better.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. Ron Luciano is my guest, and he was an umpire for 11 years, and he's written a book about those experiences called The Umpire Strikes Back. He's now a color commentator for NBC. What about slow motion? Because everybody watching at home gets to see the play replayed two or three times, but not even in real time, slowed down. So you can really see how a pitch looked or if somebody was safe or not. And certainly the viewer at home even has a better vantage point than the umpire probably did, particularly when it slowed down.
Okay, when it
how does that affect
first,
your job?
When it first came into existence, the umpires did a lot of crying. I mean, they said, oh, my gosh, no. Can you imagine having a job where a camera's looking over your shoulder and waiting for you to make a mistake? And as soon as you do it, they're ready to pounce on you. Well, we were distraught. We didn't know what to do. You can't fight television. You can't fight the industry. We didn't know what to do. Then, all of a sudden, they started to show the plays over and over and over, and we were better than Ivory Soap. We were right 99% of the time. They did a test in Chicago, and what happens was the Cubs and the White Sox, who are two different leagues, got together and said, listen, how about if we teach the first baseman how to cheat? Now, what happens is when the first baseman catches the ball, if he pulls his foot off before he catches it, then the umpire will think he's already caught it and therefore call the man safe. So they took pictures of over 100 plays, every one within 6 inches. In other words, the ball got there within 6 inches of the person's foot getting there. So everything is very close. Imagine fast motion within 6 inches. Out of 100, I think there were 11 or 12 plays. We missed one. One play was the difference. So they came out and like idiots, they told us. So we said, thank you, Instant Replay. You've just proved that we're better than most organizations or most people in the world because we're right better than 100 times out of 112. That's a phenomenal. So now when the managers came out and said, hey, you missed the play, we said, no. Go check Instant Replay. Go look at it because we're right more times than we're wrong. Now what happens is that you'll go to a ball game. They don't have it in Philly, but they have it in some ballparks. They have Instant Replay up on the screen, okay? And they will show night after night all the times that the ball player is right, the umpire's right. Then they will show maybe the 30th or the 32nd night, one out of 1,000 plays where the umpire is missed. Now, we don't mind that, except they show it over and over and over again. And Steinbrenner in New York is the worst. He showed one 8 times and then put up on the board that the umpire now umpiring at second base was Bill Kunkel from Leonardo, New Jersey. Now, do you know how bad that poor guy is? There's only 7 people in Leonardo, New Jersey. 6 of them moved out on him. I mean, it was terrible. That we didn't like. But if they just show the thing once on Instant Replay, most of the time, we'll be proven right. And so we're not afraid of Instant Replay now. It's a friend.
But if it shows that you're wrong, too bad, right? Because you have to accept the umpire's call.
Yeah. Oh, we can't ever go to changing it. And the reason we can't ever go to changing it, you have a nice manager here, a fair man, Pat Corrales. The guy is a sweetheart because he's fair. He was a catcher during his career. He caught behind Johnny Bench, and he knows that umpires are not infallible. They do make mistakes, all right? And he accepts this. So if we make a big blunder, he's going to come out and call you dirty names just to get it off his chest and be a good psychiatrist. But most of the time, he's going to leave you alone. Not all people are that fair. They're Earl Weaver with Baltimore. He would come out every single time to argue. So if we were to look at the screen, okay, and say, okay, we might have been wrong in that situation, let's check it over, all right? So in other words, use the cameras. All right. They said that in order to set this up correctly, you would need 16 cameras. Now, the Philadelphia Phillies could afford 16 cameras. Cleveland cannot afford yesterday's newspaper. So they're going to have blind umpires where Philadelphia has cameras. All right, you must have parity. They wouldn't allow that. Second of all, it would take probably with the 16 cameras to set and look at it at least 30 seconds a camera. You're talking 8 to 10 minutes for one play. With a person like Earl Weaver, who comes out 20 times a game, you're talking an extra 200 minutes for the ball game. The ball game now lasts 2.5 hours. You want to sit there for 5 hours while some idiot blind umpires keep looking at plays over and over again? It's not feasible. It's not economical. It's not baseball. Baseball, part of the charm of baseball is the human element. I mean, Mike Schmidt, if he were just a robot and hit the ball and was just iron and not a person, you couldn't relate to him. But he's flesh and blood. You know, people, they thought they swooned over Frank Sinatra, okay? You can't believe what they do to this man. I have seen people, as Mike walks out of the dressing room, walked up, touch him, literally burst into tears, and I know that hand will never be washed for years because he's touched Mike Schmidt. Now, to make him non-human or to do the same thing with an umpire and make it a robot type of game where just cameras are involved, he'd lose that personal touch. Baseball is not that stupid. It's an entertainment field, and they want the people to be entertained, and if you made cameras out of it, they won't use it.
Mm-hmm. You told us a little bit about how you judge a ball when it's coming over the plate, when it's being pitched. When a runner is sliding into a base, how do you judge where do you look and what do you listen for?
Okay, again, it's very simple. But you have to keep basic because umpires are stupid. So again, you pick an area. You pick the area around the base and you focus your eyes on that. Now, if they went into when they slide into a base, it's very difficult. If you pick an area and the ball comes over your shoulder, you watch the base, okay? You watch the man running, okay? You don't watch him. You pick the area around the base. You listen for a little flick into the glove of the catcher and you watch the foot hit the bag. And whichever comes first, that designates. If you hear the flick first, then the man is out. If you see the foot hit first, then he's safe. All right, this is what you're taught. And it's fine in the minors. It's fine in Reading, Pennsylvania, in the minor leagues of the Phillies, because you only have 2,000 or 3,000 people. But in Vet Stadium, where there's 60,000 people, you're not going to hear a little flick. So what happens after years of training, you discern a little movement in the pitcher, in the catcher's, or first baseman's foot. And so it's very easy. There's where we're right so many, many, many times because we're so trained to watch that little flick of the foot and to watch the other runner's foot hit the bag that it's become automatic and we've become a robot and we can see it. And what happens is we see that foot move, therefore he caught the ball, then the foot touches and click, out comes in. And boy, you're there and you call him out and you're very good. But we miss it a lot is where a sliding tag play. And the reason is those dumb, stupid ball players never slide the same way. They'll hook slide, and they'll come in head first like Pete Rose, and they'll go off to the right or off to the left. And what an umpire has to do is get in the right angle to see the perfect angle. That's why you need 16 cameras, to get that perfect angle. Now, one of the reasons I quit is I weigh 300 pounds, and it's hard to move blubber around like that. And so waddling around the base trying to get in the right angle, the last few years I was not moving as well, and I was missing more and more plays because the angles were wrong. So I figured I better give baseball a break and get out of it. But you try to get in the perfect angle, and then you can do it. If you put your two hands up in front of you, if you put them the two hands next to each other, parallel to each other in front of you, you can see that there's a distance between them. But if you put the left hand in front of the right or the right in front of the left, anyone looking at it from the other direction cannot tell whether the two hands are touching because it's the wrong angle. And all umpiring is a game of angles. And weighing 300 pounds is a very, very, it's not helpful to be a good umpire.
A lot of people in baseball seem to have rituals and superstitions, things that they have to do, like before you get up at bat or whatever. What are some of the weirdest ones that you've come
across? Oh, they put their shoes on a certain way. They're not allowed to put their left shoe on first. They're allowed to put their right shoe on. One of the weirdest, I think, is to put the shoes on before you put on your pants. Okay, remember, there are steel spikes on the bottom of those shoes. And do you know how many pants are ruined trying to pull them over steel spikes, and yet they refuse to put the pants on first? They have to do that. Also, they carry all kinds of gadget. There was one man who I thought, George Scott, who played in the American League for years and years, big man, loved gold and wore chains around his neck, so much so that he was hunchbacked. I'm not kidding you. The man was hunchbacked from the chains. He would come up there and it sounded like a train go, clack, 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 everything. He couldn't run anymore because of the extra weight. And we said, why don't you take those chains off? No, they're like my whale's teeth. They are teeth from other ball players that I've beaten. And so I have to wear these in order to do it. They do such things that they tuck their left arm. Their left arm sleeve has to be longer than their right arm sleeve. Do you know they go to a tailor and pay $50 to alter the uniform so that the left arm is longer than the right arm? Why? What difference does it make? They are so superstitious. That's why with some ball players, their bats mean everything. This bat means 20 line drives and 60 home runs, okay? Then they crack it and it shatters. And you can see that their wife is going to be beat up that night. Something tragic is going to happen. Their Mercedes is going to be driven into a stone wall. Everything goes on them. Because baseball, it's so hard. Remember, if you do well, you do it well 3 out of 10 times. It is so difficult that it's such a mental game. And so they do all these superstitious things to build up their mental ability. Because there's no difference between great ball players. There is between mediocre ball players, but between great ball players, Mike Schmidt and Pete Rose, there's not one bit of difference in hitting except attitude. And Mike said, oh my gosh, I got up late today because I didn't feel well. Mike's going to strike out 3 times that day because he believes it. And Pete Rose says, I don't care if I don't feel well today. I know that my bat feels well, and therefore I'll hit the ball 3 times today. And Pete's positive thinking. And all great ball players are positive thinkers because they're all on the equal parallel as far as ability is concerned. It's only mental attitude that makes the great, great Mike Schmitz.
You don't have any stuff like that as umpires.
And of course. We're right. Egomaniacs. That's why we're out there and 60,000 people say we're wrong. Right? And we firmly believe in our hearts to know that we're right. Now, you've got to be a positive thinker. You've got to be an egomaniac. What happens is we turn into a Napoleonistic attitude, and then we could become very, very pompous about the whole thing, and we become ridiculous about it. I never got to that point because I used to laugh at it.
I'm speaking with Ron Luciano, who's an umpire from 1968 to 79, and now he's a color commentator with NBC. What kind of things do you have in the press booth when you're in there for a game? What kind of information backup and what kind of backup crew behind the scenes?
Well, first of all, I can't read, so there's no reading material there. I've never learned that part of it. You have just about every single thing in the world in front of you trying to relate. Baseball is a game of records, and so we have every type of record book possible. We also have a statistician along the side of us to give us little interesting facts that will pertain to the ball game. I can remember one time I was in Fenway Park doing a game, and a guy handed me a piece of paper, and it said there were 20 shutouts in a row in 1924. And I put it on the air, and I said, oh, there were 4 shutouts in a row in 1924 here at Fenway. Score was 6-8 at the time. And a shutout is no runs, right? And so I hear over my ear the producer saying, what the heck has that got to do with a ball game? And I said, well, the guy handed it to me. You know, I've told him in between. He said, you only read those things if they pertain to the ball game. And trying to be selective is a very difficult thing because you're watching the ball game and listening. I don't know if you've ever watched TV sport games. I thought all announcers were deaf because they have a little thing coming out of their ear. And what it is an earpiece. and there's some guy in a truck that talks to you constantly while you're talking on the air, and it's the most difficult thing in the whole world to do. I could never do it. Usually, if you heard me on the game of the week, it would be something like, there's a ground ball to the shortstop. He picks it up. Okay, I'll break for 30 seconds. And then he threw the ball over to first, and everybody's saying, what's the guy talking about? One sentence has nothing to do with the other. I'm answering the guy that's talking in my ear. You can't hear him, but I can. And I could never. See, I cannot chew gum and walk at the same time. And there's no way that I can talk and listen to that man and not answer him. And it's very difficult. But we have piles of material in front of us. But looking it up to make a split-second thing, you better have great retention. Because if you look there and you say, okay, Pete Rose is going for his 49th or 50th game in a row, and he hasn't had a hit, you better remember that the person that has it in the American League and both leagues is Joe DiMaggio, who went 56 games in a row. Because there's no way you can thumb it through the book and think it up that fast. So what happens if you have a good retention, you do that. Also, every single team you go to, that particular night, their PR man gives you at least three or four sheets on current things that are happening, a hitting streak by a ball player, what a particular ball player is going through, what the team is going through, how they're doing on the road, how they've done on the road, how they're doing at home, how they've done on the road, what the pitchers are doing there. But always what happens is they'll pull some guy up out of nowhere that you didn't read about, and he comes up to the plate, and you look and say, who the heck is this guy? And right away, you've got the book out, and you're thumbing through it because there's nothing on him, and you try to relate. What was nice for me is that I had grown up with all these ball players, spent 15 years with them. So I went through the minor leagues with them in the major leagues. So I knew them on and off the field, and it was nice at times, but also it hurt because I would relate stories that had nothing to do with baseball, and they come back to me and say, don't tell things like that. I once said about Roland Office with Montreal, I said, you know, he's got a face even a mother couldn't love. I mean, that man is ugly. I've got a face made for radio. It is perfect for radio. It is an ugly face. I feel sorry for you, Terry. They sit here, watch me all this time. But I've noticed you've covered your eyes quite a bit throughout the whole interview. But I said this on the air, and you should have heard what his mother told me. I mean, I can't repeat it. She came back and he said, listen, that kid's that good-looking guy. So I used to relate things that happened off the field, and the people liked it, but the ballplayers got a little upset with it.
Well, what are you watching when you're in the press booth? Are you watching television, watching cameras? I mean, monitors?
That was another thing. It was very hard for me to do. One of the reasons I got into umpiring is because I'm blind and I had to be close to the play. Now they put me up way in the press box and I can't see that far. But if I looked at the screen, I would be limited to either a picture of the pitcher or a picture of the batter and catcher. And this hurt me very much because I couldn't always watch the screen. So I'd look down there and I'd say, oh, look at that first baseman, what he's doing. And on the time, they're showing some girl in the fifth row on the screen. So the people at home, it was very hard for me to adjust because I'm talking about one thing and something else is on the screen. So I had to learn to only talk about things that were on the screen. And that limited me very much because I wanted to talk about everything. The other thing that limited me very much in the booth was that most, being around 25 ballplayers on one side and 25 on the other side and 10 ballplayers and managers, you swear like crazy. I mean, every other word, when you get 50 or 60 men together, it's atrocious. Every other word comes out, it's macho to swear. And believe me, ballplayers try to be macho. So every other word is blank, 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 blank. Now I went on the air and they said, remember, you can't swear. 80% of my vocabulary is down the drain. So I couldn't talk about anything except what was on the screen, and I couldn't swear. And a lot of dull time was spent on the air because nobody talking.
You know, I'm sure that every broadcaster who's ever done live work has been in the position of having to talk before they knew what they were going to say or before they had something to say. What are some of the most, like, ridiculous things that you've said because you just weren't ready yet, but you had to go?
Well, most of the time, rather than me saying ridiculous things, I had a partner, Merle Harmon, who's one of the nicest people. I mean, he is so nice and so sweet. We went over to his house and he gave 5-minute grace. He said, thank you, Lord, for having this man join us this evening. I knew the roof was going to come in, had to come in. Oh, that's sacrilegious. I knew that something bad would have to happen. I have a pact with the devil, and this man is praying that and so happy to have me there. He's a sweetheart of a guy. They told me at the beginning of the year to grab Merle by the arm if I wanted to say something. Okay, and every week I'd come in, he'd sit on my right, then the next week he'd sit on my left, and the next week on my right. He came to me and I said, "You're superstitious like the ball players. We keep having to change seats." He said, "No." He said, "Look at my arms." His arms were black and blue from me grabbing him. Because when I grab, remember, I'm 300 pounds, I grab. And what's worse, that I had to call up his wife and explain to him that the bruise on his body because I grab him during the broadcast. Anyway, with Merle in the booth, he would get me out of it a lot of times. But I didn't know things, little things in television, which everyone thinks you know. Well, we were in New York, and I was talking about Bucky Dent, okay? And I hear in my earpiece, "Talk about the hero that's coming up." Well, to me, a hero's a sandwich. I said, "What the heck sandwich is coming up next?" And I look at Merle and grab him, and of course, Merle comes in with that beautiful baritone voice and says, "Of course, Ronnie, we know that, as you can see on your screen right now, that Bucky Dent hit the fabulous home run in Fenway, and we'll take a look at it right now." A hero is a graphic that explains a film that's coming up. But I don't know these things. These things are so foreign to me. They kept talking terminology, and I didn't know terminology. Another time, we were talking about Rusty Staubs in the booth, and I had a great line about Rusty Staubs. I said, "He looks like a girl, he walks like a girl, he talks like a girl, he throws like a girl, but he hits like a man." I thought it was a great line, see, a super, super thing to say about it. I didn't know that it was anti-woman or anything else. I didn't mean it to be. I meant it for a good line. I had to cough at the time, and we're hearing headsets, earphones over our ears. So I took the earphones off and the microphone that attached to them. I took it off, reached behind me, and went, and coughed, put the headset back on. Now when I put the headset back on, my stage manager who's behind me, you think we're alone up in the booth, there are 85 people up there. I mean, they're all around. One of them reached over, lifted my ear out, and said, "Press the red button." Now I'm saying, Rusty looks like a girl, talks like a girl, and I press the red button. And through my earphones, I hear, "What's going on? What's going on?" And at the same time, a guy hits my hand. Now, I want to tell him, some guy hit my hand. That's what's going on. But what happened was, the stage director told me if I wanted to cough, the red button is a cough button. Press that button, it cuts my mic off. So they're down in the truck, and my mic gets cut off. Now, the poor people at home, they hear, Rusty looks like a girl, hits like a man. Now, that doesn't make any darn sense at all. And, of course, Merle, who's the beautiful baritone, comes in and says, "Yes, Ronnie," and he gets me out of it all the time. He says, "Yes, Ronnie, what you're saying is Rusty Staubs is a feminine." I said, "No, that's not." And I hear over the loudspeaker, "Go to a commercial, please." So I kept getting into trouble because I didn't know what they were talking about. And I would see a beautiful girl in the stands, and I'd say, "Gosh, she's gorgeous." Now they're trying to kill themselves to put a girl on the picture. They're trying to get a pretty girl up, and they saw some girl who smiles and doesn't have any teeth, you know. And they kept saying, "Don't do that to us, Ron. Only talk about the game or things that are going on down there." And I'd be in Philly, and I'd say, "Okay, it's Larry Bowe up to bat now, and look at that fanatic. Look at the Philly. He's the funniest thing I've ever seen." And now they're panning around trying to get the fanatic. And the same time, Larry hits a double down the left field line, and then I revert back, and all the time Merle's going, "And yes, we know that Ronnie doesn't mean those things because you can't see him." And in the earphone I'm hearing, "Don't talk about the fanatic. Don't talk about." So if you ever listened at home and you thought it was a little garbled, you should have been where I was to think it was really garbled.
What did you think of the umpires when you were up in the press booth? You get a different vantage point on the job?
No. See, remember, umpires, there are only 52 in the whole United States. So we are a rather select group. Not select, but rather, rather close-knit group. And it's very hard to get one umpire to say a bad thing about another. And now I'm up in the booth, and I'm scared to death the first time that I'm going to see an umpire miss a play, and we're going to show it on the screen, and I'm going to have to talk about it. I do not know what to do. I cannot imagine what I'm going to do. We went 4 weeks before they missed one, just to show you how great they are. And then Jerry Neudecker was the umpire, and he was at third base. And he called a guy safe, and he was out. And I looked and I said, oh, no. Oh, I know what he did. I know what he did. I know what Jerry did. I said, look, watch his eyes. Get a picture on his eyes. Go on that replay. Because what happened was an umpire has a 50-50 chance. He's either going to watch the runner. Remember, you got to get that box. Or he's going to watch the bag. And what happened was the third baseman caught the ball and he was either going to dive for the runner or dive for the bag. And Jerry Neudecker says he'll probably dive for the runner. So he put his eyes on the runner. But the ball player dove for the bag. And he touched the bag before the runner got there. But Jerry Neudecker was looking at the runner. And he never touched the runner. Therefore, he's safe because he never touched the runner. But what he didn't know is the guy touched him behind him. He touched the bag. So he was really out, but he called him safe. And I said, I knew it. See it? See it right there? He can do it. And, of course, Murrow came in and said, all right, Ronnie, but don't get so excited. You know, we do miss plays once in a while. And I explained why he missed it. And I went down to afterwards to Jerry, and I said, Jerry, I told on the air what happened because you watched the. He said, yeah, that's exactly what I did. I looked at the runner. I didn't know the stupid idiot would go towards a bag. Those darn ball players do it to us every time. And after that, I explained that, you know, they're right. I went through 7 games before they really blew one at first base. Now, you mean probably 40, 50 calls a game times 7. That's about 350 plays before they missed one. I said, do you want me to ostracize the guy because he missed one out of 350? Of course not. Besides, I like his wife. I'm not going to pick on him now. And his kids are friends of mine, so the heck with it. And I had a good rapport with the umpires because people don't want to hear umpire stories. They'd rather hear about Mike Schmidt, about Pete Rose and the people on the field. So I talked mainly about the ballplayers and managers and left the umpires to who liked them, you know, people in cemetery.
Are there any umpire groupies?
Yeah.
There are?
Oh, yeah, there are. Sure. And listen, when you got a face like mine, you look for things like that, you know. Yeah, they're all over. They're called baseball Annies as far as, it was football Annies and baseball Marys. And they're baseball Marys, but we call them petunias. So they were baseball petunias to umpires.
So all these years that you've been either umpiring or commenting on baseball, you still love the game.
Oh, I love it. If we lived in England, I told you before, they'd have to make a night out of Doubleday. He was the smartest person in the whole world of the game. No matter how hard we try to goof up the game, the personalities can't goof it up. A couple of years ago, the umpires went on strike, tried to cause trouble, couldn't do it. Last year, the ball players tried to cause on strike. There's more people come to the ball game this year. Bui Hume has tried to ruin the game as commissioner. I mean, the things he does are so outlandish. And the things he doesn't do are even more outlandish. And yet he doesn't hurt the game at all. It's such a super ball game. It really is. And because of the personalities and because there's so many of them and because you can play it 162 times a year for one regular season, you know, a football team, the Eagles are a great, super team, but they only play at home 7 times during the regular season. The Phillies play 81 times at home. Do you know? And you can do things with football that you care with baseball that you can't do with football or hockey. You can listen to a baseball game and mow the lawn at the same time. You can't mow a lawn and listen to, well, first of all, it's too cold, but you can't shovel the walk and listen to a football game because you have to be right there and you have to glue your ear to this. But baseball, there's so many things that can happen during a game that other things can be involved. It's got so many good qualities to it. In football, if you lose, oh, my gosh, what a downer. You lost today. Then you have to go. First of all, you prepared for it for 6 days. Then the 7th day you lost. Now you got to prepare for another game for 6 days. So you spend 2 weeks as a loser. But in baseball, if you won 100 games a year, that means you lost 62. And if you win 100, you're going to win the pennant. But you lost 62. Can you imagine the Eagles losing 62 games? My gosh, that's 17 coaches to go through. That's changing the teams 40 times. It's the same way with the 76ers. Can you imagine them losing 62 ball games? You wouldn't talk to them. They wouldn't be on television. You wouldn't see them anymore. So baseball is so great because you can lose and still win.
Well, I've enjoyed this enormously, and I want to thank you so much for telling us some of your stories about baseball. It's really been great fun. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. I'm terrible. I talk so much we didn't play any jazz. That's terrible. But please, do one thing. Tell the listeners to buy the book because I need the money.
Well, the book is called The Umpire Strikes Back, not to be confused with the film. You're going to have a sequel to this, no doubt.
Oh, right? The Umpire Strikes Back Again.
That's right. And The Umpire Strikes Back is published by Bantam. My guest is Ron Luciano, who was an umpire from 68 to 79 and then joined NBC as a color commentator. And thanks again for talking with us.
Oh, Terry, it's been a pleasure.
It's 2 minutes to three. This is 91 FM, and you're listening to Fresh Air. And in a couple of minutes, we'll be hearing more about baseball, but from a different point of view. There's a play that opened last night at Philadelphia Festival Theater called Triple Play, and it's a play of three vignettes about baseball players. And we'll be meeting the director of that play in just a couple of minutes. This is Robert Klein.
Babe Ruth's story, you're so bad, really. Babe is such a great character. What a corny rendition. He's up there, sick in the bed, you know, three floors below. Street urchins. Take me out to the ballgame. Even oohs, okay? In the middle of the Bronx. Anyway, upstairs they're hurling baseball metaphors and cliches around like it's going out of style. You hear those kids, Doc? They're big league. Okay, babe. Father Matthias. What, babe? No one can strike you out. You're Babe Ruth. Thanks, Doc. Sam Levine, his friend. Slide, babe. What the hell is that, babe? Babe?
Yeah, Doc?
You've got a serum here. Kind of a pinch hitter, you could say.
Hey, that's a good idea, Doc.
It's never been tried on... Goslings is about all so far. But babe, if this works, then millions of people can get their last licks too.
Doc?
Yes, babe?
This pinch hitter, can he bunt?
Babe, the metaphors are possibly going a little too far now. Bunt. In a way, I suppose he can.
What if he catches that third baseman playing a little deep, Doc? Let him lay one down, eh? How many outs?
Father Matthias, take over here. Not that much into baseball. I'm a doctor.
Thank you.
That was Max Morath and his band on the Dill Pickles Rag, and we opened that set with a routine by Robert Klein. It's 4 minutes after...